welcome to this week's episode of the Substation podcast. So this is the final episode that we have in our series on data. So in this episode, we are going to provide concluding thoughts and a bit of a wrap up, a bit of a roundup. Tom, how are we going to do that?
So I think we've decided that it's a good way to kind of round this off is to conclude through a kind of speculative fiction lens, where we're going to try and imagine a world where some of the stuff we've talked about is implemented, and what does that practically mean for users of the energy system.
Does the term speculative fiction also mean sci-fi?
Yes, it's a way of saying sci-fi without sounding too nerdy.
Is this our steampunk episode?
I mean, I am wearing a flat cap, so okay. It could be.
I'm imagining Blade Runner.
Yeah, that's... I'm not sure if it's cyberpunk is Blade Runner.
No, I don't know. I'm just mixing up my terms.
One of the best films ever made, so it's always a good reference to get in somewhere. So we've snappily decided that we're going to call this Energy Data Utopia and Energy Data Dystopia. We're going to start off with the utopias because they're more fun to talk about. And it turns out it was easier to come up with utopias than it was dystopias. So
can I, as somebody who always really likes to set the context and understand the question well, how are we defining utopia and dystopia? What do those words actually mean?
So without having to resort to a dictionary, I believe utopia means like an ideal version of the future. So something to strive for where, you know, all of the problems of society affects. I think that's, you know, kind of what we're getting for. It's an ideal, a good thing to occur. And then a dystopia is a version of society where some of the worst things have happened. It's a bad outcome. We're not achieving what we would like to be achieving. Okay, so my first idea is I'm calling real-time pricing as standard. So in this world, we've collected enough information about the system, we've standardized it, and we make it transparent, and there is clear pricing rules available to every user of the system in real time. So this means that each user of the system can see down to their local substation level what the capacity of each part of the kit that's connected to them is, and who else is connected to it, and what they've done in the recent and the distant past. And then there is some sort of algorithm that can... that's got an easy set of rules that are easily predictable, so that as long as you've got the same data, you can get the same answer out. And it takes all of that information about the system in real time, and it can calculate some sort of price signal about how over or underutilized each asset on the system is. So it can then determine some kind of scarcity price for that node on the network. This price can then send a signal of, you know, if the asset is overutilized, so there's lots of people who are either drawing power or putting power onto that piece of equipment, then it's going to be expensive to use because it means that we need to invest in more equipment at that point on the network. And if it's underutilized, then it's going to be cheap to use. So this would mean that because all of that data is transparent, easily accessible, and there's a clear, understandable, predictable algorithm that takes that information, if you can work out what you're planning to be doing with that information, or with that asset, you can work out what the price for using it is. And if you can do, and if it does that in real time, you can work out, okay, if I put a megawatt on, I'm going to pay this much, and if I take a megawatt off, I'm going to pay that much. As long as all these other conditions are also true, and I've got a lot of data about that piece of equipment, so that I can work out all of that myself, either based on historics or some sort of predictive process.
Question. Is what you're describing what some people might know as nodal pricing?
Partly. I think that, yes, but kind of to the nth degree. Let's go even further than that and take it down to, like, close to real time as possible on megawatts, not megawatt hours. Let's have hugely transparent information about it, and maybe it's just for the network capacity as well, because it might not be about the energy. So for one of the things you could say is that, well, okay, I want to use this substation over here, but the actual energy price, I need to buy the power from someone as well, so I say buy it from you. You've got a solar panel nearby or on the same location or even across the country, and we agree a price. So let's say we agree that I'll pay you £50, and we could even then say, okay, well, actually it turns out I get paid £35 at, I pay £35 at my node, you earn £45 at your node, So actually, we have some sort of CFD between us that allows me to pay you £5. You still get your £50, and I only pay £35. So I'm still £5 better off than actually paying £50. And we could have some sort of arrangement around that kind of thing. And you'd be able to work out a chain, like the price chain from bringing it from the offshore wind farm, because you'd to calculate the, say, the price for my power from an offshore wind farm. Maybe I bought it from the wind farm at £10. Then I look at all of the lines and the nodes in between me and the wind farm, look at, it then calculates all the power flows going on and off it, and actually works out that we add on £15 for all the under or over utilization of that assets. And that means that maybe I can have an algorithm that actually looks at saying, oh, well, hold on, there's a solar farm that's offering, that's 3 kilometers closer, and actually we run that algorithm and it thinks the price will come out at £10 for using that solar farm. So maybe I can offset some of the power I'm bringing from far away with some of the power I'm using close by.
So this world of lots of prices, lots of data, what are the things that are missing that to make that happen, or what things will need to happen to make that possible?
Open and transparent data about the transmission kit and everyone who's connected to it and the way they use it. So there's maybe some questions about data protection. Perhaps if it's sufficiently aggregated, we can protect people who, so that no personal data is being made available. And then there's also the idea of this algorithm that I'm talking about, so a clear and transparently applied set of rules. It's likely that it'd be a very complicated rule book, but I'm sure that there's a way that we can make it sufficiently clear enough that a machine can read and understand it and apply that rule book. Maybe some sort of smart contract.
So there's a big single central algorithm, one algorithm to rule them all. Is that what we're talking in this
Yes.
sci-fi
So
world, if I'm
there's
just
one
gonna
algorithm, but maybe it isn't run centrally. It could be run individually by lots of different parties, but the rules around the algorithm are always the same. So yeah, so each individual DNO or trader or whatever runs the algorithm, but as long as they run it to the same rule book as everybody else, and the actual steps of the algorithm are the same.
In my mind, it would be equivalent to what we have for day-ahead trading now, where there's effectively a single set of rules for optimizing things at the day-ahead stage. But you can have different power exchanges that run those rules and different ways of, that people interact with them. But still, the how that market is done is effectively centralized and prescribed. I guess, what are the risks, say, if we did have this world of real-time pricing and lots of data in place? And clever, whizzy algorithms with clear centralized rules, what would the potential risks or potential unintended consequences be of something like this?
So, in this system, I'm imagining there's very little central dispatch, because what we're saying is that the algorithm will give us the signal about whether or not that asset works. So, the algorithm would determine if there was enough voltage or whatever, and the price would be set, and there would be enough information theoretically that people could contract to know that, okay, if I do this at this location, it will result in this action. And I can run the algorithm and it'll tell me, okay, this price will come out of that because maybe there's not enough voltage on this part of the network. So I need to contract to somebody who can provide reactive power in that location, or I pay this fee. So there might be a perhaps risk that there isn't enough central control to protect against runaway conditions. So there might be a much greater role for planning. For example, because you'd need to put the kit and automatic processes in place to kind of pick up in case trigger conditions were met. So, for example, if the market concludes a solution that's not brilliant, actually, then some sort of protective backup system would kick in and smooth the system out. But then there'd have to be some sort of, maybe you could have some sort of vol arrangement, so a value of lost load or a value of failed market solution.
Penalties.
Yeah, a penalty price would kick in to say, okay, the market got this wrong, guys. You've got to pay this penalty for that.
There's always going to be need for a central role in my mind. Maybe in some worlds that becomes smaller, but real-time balancing. That has to
Yeah,
be,
I think what this is also trying to do is to try to remove as much of that as possible. to say that actually the more information you give the market about how the system itself actually works, and that if you can make that signal about how it should work,
if you
can price it so that parties know what the system has to do, know what the penalty for it not doing it is, they can then decide how best to achieve that. And therefore you don't need the central body to step in real time and make it happen that way. But whether or not you can actually do that, because, so for example, it kind of works that way in the internet, as I understand. So like the broadband, the way the internet allocates bandwidth to parties kind of works that way. But the other thing about the internet is that you can squeeze the data, or it's okay for some of the data to not arrive because you can send it again later. So actually, you know, there is a price. So if you want your data to arrive when you send it, you pay a lot of money if it's a constrained time, but you can wait a bit because, you know, most transactions don't need to happen right away. So yeah, you can wait a couple of seconds, but in electricity you can't.
And the consequences of an outage are arguably greater.
Yeah.
Definitely greater. Cool. Okay. So that's Utopia 1, real-time pricing as standard. Prices everywhere, nodes everywhere. I see the world you're painting.
Mm-hmm.
What's Utopia number 2?
So I call this one digital personal brokers for everyone. So the way that pulsar markets allow access and that the settlement systems operate improves to the extent that the cost to entry lowers to a huge extent, so that maybe like the amount of there's enough communications settlement systems in place to allow really small participants to trade and get access to N2EX or APX or whatever future market arrangements there might be, and that the settlement system for electricity, you know, it's not, you don't have to spend £20,000 to register a supply license. You can actually just download a smart contract off Ofgem's website that will automate your entry into the supply market. So you can, like, just as a house on your own, enter the supply market. And then you could have other market participants offering individualized trading patterns, so they can sell you machine learning algorithms or other smart assistants that can take all your input patterns or consumption data, and they can forecast or pre-program how you want to use your electricity and buy that for you, or sell it if you've got a solar panel or an electric vehicle or whatever. So in this example, I've contracted with Emma Supply Co. You sell me a program, an app that sits on maybe my Apple phone or my Amazon Alexa or whatever smart assistant program that's also hooked into my lighting, my heating, my fridge, and other bits and pieces of my appliance.
Is it called the Emma app?
The Emma app, yeah.
Sure, yeah.
And your dulcet tones respond that I'm going, my plan is tomorrow to go out to work. The app goes, yes, sure, that's fine. And normally I wake up and leave the house at 7:30. So I wake up at 6:30, I have a shower and a breakfast that are usually at fairly predictable times. So that digital assistant looks at my meter and looks at all the history that it's got of me and goes, okay, well, he usually wakes up at 6:30 and has a shower and then has breakfast. So I'll buy some power for his alarm clock at this time, and some power for the shower at this time, and some power for the breakfast at this time. And it can pre-book all of that capacity, and maybe the digital assistant might actually talk to my neighbor's battery, which is fully charged because maybe they just, they had the car pre-charged for an expected journey, but maybe the car and its own digital assistant goes, well, actually, I've probably got enough of the journey tomorrow, so I'll sell it to you. Or maybe if the wind, you know, if it's windy, then it just buys the power from the wholesale market or something like that. And all I need to do as a consumer is predetermine the level of engagement and how much I'm willing to pay. So I just tell my smart assistant, okay, you know what I do. You know how much power I need to do what I normally want to do. Go and buy me the power I need. And this is how much I'm willing to pay. You know, go up to this price. And I can also choose, okay, actually, maybe I want to fine tune it. So I could be like, well, actually, I feel like I want to make sure that my price for the wind, you know, I pay no more than on average 50, 60, 70 pounds a megawatt hour. So maybe I can predetermine the hedging that I'm willing to do and set those kind of parameters. So yeah, I call that digital personal brokers for everyone.
this is the world that we often end up talking about or have done in various episodes, where there's sort of smart meter data everywhere, metering everywhere, smart homes, smart appliances, all that good stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. So I think those are definitely necessary conditions. Like, we need to have decent meter data, needs to be available to everybody. Maybe there's a pinch of idea one in here as well, that there are some sharper prices. But yeah, I think those are definitely absolutely necessary. We need to make sure, you know, everyone has to have a smart meter, whether or not that is an actual smart meter or a half hourly meter or a even smarter meter, asset level metering or something like that.
And then the market rules, industry processes that support that. So things like market wide half hourly settlement. So actually using those smart meters and their data in the market settlement processes.
Exactly.
I'm somebody who obviously engages quite a lot with organizations that take a lot of my data. And sometimes I wish they would do more with the data that they have of me. So I'm probably somebody who's very open to this kind of world where my Alexa or Google thing or other brands available to, you know, would just sort of optimize my world for me in terms of also the lighting and the whatever other ambient things you have in your gaff. I suppose that works for me, I suppose, for what kind of customers would that not work for? Or what would the downsides, I suppose, of this approach be? Or are we going to get into that in the dystopia?
Well, partly that, but I have a specific dystopia that kind of is like the Black Mirror version of this, but I think there are also some unintended consequences. So presumably because human beings are irrational and don't always follow patterns, you could end up in, say, a world where you get a really surprising bill. So normally you get, like, you know, you're spending a low amount every day and then you see in your bill, whoa, that's just suddenly jumped up. And it's because you did something that the algorithm didn't expect you to do. So it's actually, you know, you had to pay imbalance prices or something because you consumed something in a way that it hadn't planned for. So that's, you know, within machine learning framework, that's perfectly reasonable thing that might happen. And then perhaps that algorithm might overcompensate later, and actually you end up with higher bills later than they have to be because you've returned back to your normal pattern, but it's scared that you might do something strange again, a strange in inverted commas, and it's overbuying when it doesn't need to. So it depends on how smart these things are going to be, how much aggregation you want to put in it. But I think for even for unengaged customers, it might even be that a supplier does this for you and you don't even know about it. So you could actually have this broker that you don't actually personally engage with, it's not connected to any of your systems, but because the supplier knows so much about you now that they're actually running that kind of machine learning algorithm on your behalf and buying for you as part of a portfolio. So it could still work for unengaged customers.
I think my concern with this is that this is sort of, in some ways you can sort of see how it can happen from a market rules regulation perspective, but then equally talking about smart houses and smart appliances, like, has anyone ever really made it work and made all those investments worthwhile? Like, the complexity of getting all those pieces right, optimizing your solar and your battery, you know, and your EV charger with all the other whizzy stuff. I still feel like, you know, there's so many ducks that need to align for this to happen. And I still feel like there's a good few things probably that need to be ironed out for all of that to work.
I think for the big kit, so for things like boilers, solar panels, storage heaters, batteries. Yeah, there's definitely people who've managed to optimize all of their kind of major appliances. Whether or not we'll get it down to the small appliances, or whether or not that's even necessary. Because I definitely think it works for the big intensive stuff. Would you like to hear idea number three?
Please.
Okay, so idea number three is open digital twins running in parallel to the real system. So I think we talked briefly about the idea of a digital twin in the transmission episode. So a digital twin is basically all of the engineering information that you need about assets on the system so that you can simulate their performance under a range of conditions. Now, I think this week or maybe the week before, National Grid actually held a webinar on them launching their digital twin. So we're not that far away from this being a reality. But the nuance to this one is that this open source database comes with a software package, so that maybe an open source software package or I don't know, a licensable version or something, but that would allow the parties to see real-time simulation of how the grid is operating, and then they can also make sure that how they can look backwards and see that it being benchmarked against real life as well. So you can then take this database and the package, and you can use it to simulate future performance with input parameters of your own. So that you could then say, okay, well, I'm a developer, and I want to connect to this bay in a substation here, but I don't know what my nuance will be, and I want to know how often I'm going to be constrained, and I want to know how often I'll be constrained under my own range of input assumptions. So maybe in a world where, you know, lots of wind farms are connecting around me, I put in all of my assets and my assumptions, and it simulates that and shows me all of the, you know, the times that I'm going to be constrained, and maybe what level of inertia is needed, or short circuit level support, and all that sort of stuff about the system and how I think it's going to change. It could even be things like, oh, I'm currently constrained 10% of the time in this part of my network. But what happens if that housing development that's being talked about being planned connects at the next bulk supply point over? What am I, do my constraint volumes change in that situation? Does that mean I want to support this housing development or oppose it, because it affects how my network is going to be used? So I think that could be a powerful tool. I guess maybe speaking as a consultant, that might be something that engineering consultants would like to provide rather than it being an open source thing, but I guess maybe developers would prefer that it was this live open database at the very least, and maybe a supported software package alongside.
Yeah, well, you can see it getting to a point where the data, the underlying data, is open, but to be able to kind of interpret it and make sense of it might be a different story.
Yeah, I think you'd have to have some, there'd have to be some sort of, at the very least, grid guidance or network operator guidance about how to use it, just to make sure that it kind of reflected how they thought it should operate. But as long as that kind of benchmarking is also there, so that you can look backwards and say, okay, the simulation package is completely out of step with reality, then that would probably be okay.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of things are we saying we would need to have to make this world happen?
So we need this digital twin, and we need it to be free and open source, or if not necessarily open source, you know, easily accessible, open, presumed open, let's go with that. Which we should be getting to, that I think we've probably got, I'd say that's baked in. There'd probably need to be decent governance of it as well, and maybe there'd need to be some form of, to make it really truly useful, we'd need to have data, not just data about the network, but also about how people are expected to connect to and use the network in the future and in the past. So you know, maybe this needs to be hooked into planning databases and future energy scenarios outputs, or Bayes CFD allocation round data, so that it can all be, you know, so that you can actually do useful things with it and say, hey, there's a factory coming in a year's time, and there's all these solar panels are expected to connect, and there's a battery here, and it usually operates like this, or it's usually in a frequency response contract or something like that. Yeah, I think we need open data, and we need this digital twin to be available.
And what are the risks or unintended consequences of something like this?
So I guess the risk is that it's too complicated and very, very expensive. That, and maybe it's only useful to a limited number of people, so it doesn't necessarily get built or invested in, because maybe it's deemed to, I mean, I guess someone would have to do that, to do the impact assessment, to work out if it would be value for money, because hey, it would be useful to me in my day job, but whether or not it would be a good spend for the country to make via electricity bills funding the ESO under its price control would be one of the major blockers. So yeah, I'm not sure if anyone's done a cost benefit analysis on that, so that might be a risk to to whether or not, because it could come out very expensive depending on the background systems that you need to run this. So perhaps it might be something that you need to wait for Grid and all the DNO's digital infrastructure to be upgraded before we can move to this kind of software, just because the spend required to hook up the old legacy systems to this new system might be very expensive. And I'm not sure on what the securities of supply implications might be about having a accurate real-time simulation of the electricity system would be. And that might be a question for government, I suppose.
That's one of the things when it comes to sort of security of supply of information, privacy of information. It's often the kind of sentiment, I suppose, the public sentiment that can drive the direction of how things work. Do you know that kind of way? Which could be the case in terms of this as well. Okay, so that's your three dystopias. So in the first world, it's pricing on nodes everywhere. Real-time pricing is standard. Second one, you've got some kind of, at a very kind of local level, a broker intervening and optimizing your life effectively.
Yep.
And therefore the price that you pay. And in the third world, you have really informed developers and decisions, and they are informed by detailed, useful, open digital twins that drive better decisions about where things should be located and how they should be run.
Yeah.
Are these, I mean, I take it these worlds are not necessarily mutually exclusive.
No.
So there is a kind of overarching utopia where all things apply.
Yeah, they could. You could see a world in which, yeah, you've got real-time pricing algorithms across a nodal market with digital brokers who have access to information and markets that allow optimization of household scale electricity consumption alongside open digital twins. In fact, actually, I'd say that maybe the open digital twins might actually be needed for that real-time pricing model as well, thinking about it.
Yeah, they're kind of self-supporting or interplaying.
Synergistic at the very least.
Cool. So that's utopias. What about the business of dystopias?
Yes. So I did find it a bit harder to come up with some dystopias, but I have managed to come up with two. So dystopia idea number one, push notification hell. So this is the idea where you've got an app which interacts with your supply account and whoever is providing the supplier, and they know a lot about you and a lot about your consumption, but also a lot about some other data that allows them to make decisions. So for example, they might know your credit score, or they think a lot about your payment history, and they use this information to basically give you lots of nudges and messages to drive vulnerable or disengaged customers to lower their energy usage. So it could be, for example, that they send you messages whenever the price is spiking. They'll send you text messages saying, by the way, the price is spiking tonight. If you want to avoid paying a lot for your electricity or having your bill go up, you need to not use less energy now. And it could come across in a very happy, friendly, positively marketed message, but still have very negative outcomes. So in this case, where there are time of use tariffs, these suppliers are constantly bombarding customers with instructions to lower consumption, and maybe the messaging could come across as threatening or concerning, i.e. like your bills will go up if you do this, or the system security is tight, it's going to be a cold winter, maybe you want to save gas to save the country or something. And then that could lead to unnecessary stress or reduction in energy use for important things like cooking, cleaning, education, or relaxing. So the last thing we want is for children to be sitting in the dark, not able to use computers because their parents are concerned about being able to afford the bill at the end of the month.
Can I just say, even before energy and all the other implications are part of this, any life in which I have more push notifications would be to me hell.
Yeah.
I'm the guy who just doesn't want that in her life. My phone's on silent constantly. I've got all my notifications turned off. And if I had to respond and make all these little micro decisions that actually then had implications for my energy bills, my energy usage. Oh, I just got better things. Although I've got other things I would rather be doing with my time and my day. So this definitely sounds like hell.
And it's likely that maybe suppliers would try not to do this because, as you say, it sounds very unpleasant to have to interact with your phone in this manner. You know, your phone can already be a source of stress. If it's also a source of stress about money, then that's unpleasant. But you can imagine a world in which the lower end customers are kind of on suppliers who are actively trying to get them to use less because they have problems paying and they don't want to get into like bad debt situations. And hopefully, to be honest, I'm not an expert on customer protection law, so I don't know how likely necessarily this would be, but it does sound like a dystopia to me, and one in which is vaguely realistic because you've already got people who work on apps. So you get, say for example, you're an Uber driver, you've got to, you get a job and it comes up and pings and you get to decide whether or not to do it, but in reality you don't know if the algorithm would punish you for taking that job or not. So it's a we already live in an app mediated society. Who's to say that your energy supply won't also move in that kind of gig economy, app driven way, and it becomes a source of anxiety and stress.
Well, I mean, to take it to a very Black Mirror place, there's that kind of one end where you've got, what's it called, like social credits. Like, I know when you mentioned earlier looking back at people's credit history and making an assessment or a judgment on terms or whatever being offered to that customer as a result, almost feels a little bit in that direction, doesn't it, in this dystopia?
Yeah, I mean that's, I guess, isn't there a system in China that determines the a credit available to you based on your citizenship and how good a citizen you are? So, you could see this kind of technology intertwining with various other parts of your life around energy use, air miles, food, perhaps if there's like maybe an NHS app or something in there that looks at the calories you consume and the steps you're taking. And links that to your energy consumption. And yeah, you could see a very, I mean, there's nothing to say that the future will be better than the past. And you can definitely see in certain industries how like a platform-driven economy has actually made people's lives more precarious and less fun.
Is this a kind of Blade Runner? Have we gotten into the Blade Runner territory now?
Is this like Blade Runner? I mean,
What's an appropriate sci-fi to reference at
well,
this point?
this, I mean, you Black
Black
Mirror
Mirror, yeah.
is a good one here. I mean, we're not quite in Children of Men territory. I mean, Blade Runner is taking place in a polluted future LA in which ecological collapse is rife and humanity is fleeing the planet.
It's funny that you said Blade Runner was set in the future because it was actually set in November 2019.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So,
And
yeah.
actually, what was it? England was the inspiration for Blade Runner, because when the director was in, I think it was the Northeast, and they were going past the Tyneside Refinery, and that's the kind of inspiration for the opening shot with all the flares going off.
Ooh.
Because we did in my environmental science class at university, one of the lectures was watching Blade Runner and talking about the environmental implications.
All right, so that's the first dystopia. Do you have another?
I do have another, and I developed this one in association with you, so feel free to,
I knew the answer to the question, though. I
yeah,
just.
so feel free to interject, but we call this one permanent stasis. So this is a world in which changes was too hard, so either through delays or we found out later that it was too expensive, or the
Yeah.
IT professionals weren't there and available, that we didn't make the changes.
This one I wanted to throw in because this one kind of feels somewhat realistic, right? Like that there's, like we assume when we're making plans or looking at the market and what's going to happen, that X, Y, and Z things will happen at when they're meant to, right? Like that plans will be implemented on time. And this maybe doesn't represent a dystopia, maybe that just, this represents just the more conservative or less optimistic way of looking at the future of the market.
So I think the difference between this idea and that is that we decide at some point that it was too hard, and we just kind of either permanently put it on the shelf or decide to not do anything, that it's just too hard to make a change. So I don't think this isn't like a base case scenario or anything. It's like it is literally we make the conscious decision that we've got better things to do and don't actually want to do things like complete the smart meter rollout or make mandatory half-hourly settlement take place. So I do think it's, I know you're saying this it's a realistic scenario, but I don't think it's the base case.
No, I agree.
Yeah. And that's the key thing, is in this scenario, there must be something else that means we have to be spending our energy on doing something else, because I think it's been clear from what we've learned so far that most people think these changes are good ideas, and that most of the modelling and impact assessments that have been done have said, agrees, and, you know, say quantitatively, this is a good idea. It's a good idea to spend money on this. Mm. So there has to be a good reason why we decided not to do them. So what do you think protects against this? Like, why?
I guess.
Don't you think it's likely?
Well, I think what we've also seen is how quick innovation can be, and how quick data and technology can advance, which is often faster than things like market rules. So while there are some big programs of work that we're waiting on getting things done, like market-wide half-hourly settlement, the supporting infrastructure will hopefully move at pace to be able to deliver the kinds of innovations and products that we want to see in the market, to see this, you know, the right kind of behavior from the retail side. So yeah, I'm kind of, the protection in my mind is this. Yeah, on the one hand, things can be slow or slower or might not happen. But on the other hand, other things can be fast and happen faster and better than we could have anticipated.
There's a lot of inertia in this market, pun intended. But there's also a lot of pressure to move things on as well, because it's recognised that there is inertia and there are people out there who want to make the future happen.
I agree. So I'm an optimist. That's what protects. Optimism protects against this, Tom.
Yeah.
okay, so that's our two dystopias.
Well, in which case, I think it's time to move on to our concluding thoughts. I think you said before that these ideas, or the utopias that they fit together, are any mutually exclusive? Or do you think there's anything going on in the market that would block any of the things that we just talked about?
Well, I guess, I mean, there's always that risk, and you kind of touched on it earlier, of this sort of two-tier market, where you have some customers who are able to benefit from certain things, but on the flip side, you've got other customers existing alongside them in the same market who are ultimately being harmed by some of these interventions. So, yeah, I guess there's a potential for a dystopia and a utopia to be coexisting, and perhaps that's what we would expect.
And of course, we've got to get, we need to have the widest possible buy-in in order to reach our objectives, because then basically net zero is the re-engineering of a fundamental part of society, and it will impact on everyone's life. So the fairer, more transparent we can make it, the easier it will be for everyone to bear the burden of this enormous generational change we have to undergo.
Because what we didn't talk about today explicitly, but we certainly will another day in more detail, are our interventions for protecting customers and protecting vulnerable customers, and how do they sit alongside a market that can deliver, you know, that more whizzy, innovative offer, and how do those two things coexist in a world? I think there's some interesting debates to be had there as well, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think I do think that there probably are customer protection laws that would protect against the kind of push notification hell idea. I'm not familiar with what they would be, but I'm sure that it can't be, at least in the current license conditions, the suppliers aren't able to just like constantly message you about your consumption. So yeah, I there must be some protections in place already, but I don't know what they are. So what do you think, not just looking at our speculative fiction attempts, what would you say the main lessons we've learned have been so far looking at data in energy?
I think from my side, it's that it is not as bad as I thought. So I think, I mean, I guess I still think that we are where we are 10 years ago when I first entered the industry in some ways. Like that's kind of what I expect. And there's so many examples of people doing more and using data better and more clever and using assets better and more cleverly. So yeah, it was kind of nice to take stock and kind of look end to end and see how much has happened in the last 10 years, really, which again, yeah, it gives me hope and optimism for the next 10 years. What about you?
So there's lots going on, and there's lots of experiments and stuff. So yeah, I guess I'd share that optimism that it's not as bad as maybe it first seems. And I think the other thing I would say is that while we've got lots of people moving about in data, unlocking many of the real benefits is also going to involve lots of hard work in legislation, regulation, and infrastructure.
Mm.
So getting that half-hourly world with time-of-use tariffs and being able to settle parties on that is basically it's a legislative, you know, we've had the legislation, we're doing the regulation, we need to get the infrastructure all in place, and all of that needs to work in sync. The same thing for kind of markets for everything, or better transmission planning, or locational prices to signal how to move things, or getting the DNOs to dispatch stuff within their own network. All of this is actually not, it's not just the realm of data.
Mm.
It's also the realm of legislation, regulation, and infrastructure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yeah, I guess there's the kind of sense that things are moving in the right direction, but the whole thing is kind of just this mishmash of legacy systems. You know, rules, processes that were created 20 years ago, that are layered on top of each other's, and, you know, different patches and sellotape, resulting in this.
So yeah, it's like a Gordian knot of regulations and systems.
Exactly. So I suppose, yeah, there's a lot of different moving pieces, I guess, and it can be frustrating not seeing them all moving together, because, you know, that probably means it will take longer.
But if it's a Gordian knot, that means that you can just cut it, right?
Do we need some sort of special sword?
Yeah. Do you think, is there a Gordian knot style solution?
Is it an algorithm?
Yeah, but the maybe, but the algorithm itself is going to be at least half as complicated.
Be grand, we'll name it after a sword. So that's data.
That's data.
Done. Tick.
Dusted.
Wipe our hands. Dust our shoulders off.
We want to do security of supply next, don't we?
I think so. I still, no other topic or theme has more taken my fancy.
Thanks for listening. I've been Tom, and
I've been Emma.
And you've been listening to the Substation Podcast.